The Annie E. Casey Foundation.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Wolf. On the first part of today's program, are there problems with Amendment 4, the amendment that was just passed that would restore voting rights to many people who are felons who have served their sentences? We're going to talk about that first. Later on, we'll open up the phone lines. But before we do that, one listener comment about yesterday's program. Yesterday, we covered a lot of topics, including Professor Stephen Cohen's skepticism about the Russia investigation. And after the show, here's what one listener had to say.
This is Teresa in St. Pete. I have a comment about today's show, Wednesdays. The reason we're in this mess with Russia is because of Trump and his campaign. They all met with Russians, and they all lied about it, and Putin wants a puppet in there, and he's got one. He wanted him in there. That's why we're in the mess, because of Trump. And he met with them secretly in the White House. We didn't know about it. We saw the pictures from Russia. He met with Putin secretly. God only knows what they're talking about. So this is on him and the campaign. They did this to themselves. And about Republicans, what they're doing to Wisconsin and everything, I'm not surprised. The people of Wisconsin and Michigan and Ohio and any of the other states that have flipped to Democratic governorships and stuff, they don't listen to the voice of the people. The people voted for a liberal Democrat. That's what they voted for. That's what they want. Republicans don't listen. They are just out destroying this country.
There you have a listener comment that came in after yesterday's program. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. I'm just going to read from a story earlier this week in the Tampa Bay Times, and it's about the Amendment 4 that was passed by voters just a few days ago in the Florida election. The report says that Florida voters spoke clearly 4 weeks ago. They restored the right to vote to most convicted felons who complete their sentences. When it becomes Florida's law in 5 weeks, an estimated 1.2 million felons will be eligible to rejoin the voter rolls. But at a statewide elections conference on Tuesday in Sarasota, it was obvious that confusion and uncertainty still hovers over implementation of Amendment 4. The uncertainty raises the possibility that counties will interpret Amendment 4 differently, which could trigger lawsuits that raise equal protection issues. Before November 6th, Florida was by far the largest of four states that permanently stripped the right to vote from convicted felons. Counties wanted clear direction from the state, but the state's position is that the legislature should have a voice, the same legislature that for decades refused to address the issue of felons' voting rights, which prompted advocates to collect enough voter signatures to force a statewide referendum bypassing the legislature. Here to talk about the future of Amendment 4 is Reggie Garcia. He's an attorney in Tallahassee. He's represented people who are seeking their voting rights to be restored at the clemency hearings in Tallahassee before the Florida Cabinet, something that was instituted by Governor Rick Scott. And Reggie, welcome back to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Rob, and I am a Tampa native, and thank you for inviting me and all you do to keep the community informed and engaged.
All right, so after reading that Tampa Bay Times story earlier this week, the headline, Confusion Clouds Restoration of Florida Felons' Voting Rights, I was thinking that it's not going to be clear and simple on January 1st when this amendment takes effect that people who've served their time may not get their rights automatically restored. What do you say?
Well, the meeting you refer to was the State Association of Supervisors of Elections. We, of course, have 67 counties in Florida, including Hillsborough, where you are, and Leon, where I am. And I believe all of those are independently elected constitutional officers. So I think the headline was a little misleading in a sense that no one that I'm aware of at the legislature is talking about slow walking this. To the contrary, both presiding officers have said, they want to move forward with this and enact the will of the people. So what you have is Amendment 4, and remember, there were a lot of them, but this was one of only two put on the ballot by 843,000 voters. It passed. It got almost 65% of the vote. So the 1.7 million convicted felons we have in Florida, which before could not vote unless the governor and cabinet restored their civil rights, Amendment 4, which takes effect January 8th, 2019, almost a month from now, the same day our new governor and cabinet are inaugurated, that same group of convicted felons which couldn't vote now will be able to vote, with the exception there was an exclusion if someone commit, a felon committed murder or a sex offense.
All right, so are you saying to people, let's say that there is somebody who's served their time as a felon and they paid all their debt to society and it was a nonviolent offense, it didn't involve murder or a sex crime, coming up in January when this amendment takes effect, they can just go down to their supervisor of elections office and sign up to vote, and that's it. They will be eligible voters.
Certainly the drafters of the amendment feel that, I'll read the operative phrase because it says shall twice in the amendment, that there's currently a Form 39, which is the current Division of Elections promulgated form that has 11 questions and a signature block. And question 2, it's really more of a declaration, says, I affirm that I am not a convicted felon, or if I am, my right to vote has been restored. Well, that current form refers to clemency restoration of rights, but on January 8th, arguably, this form, my right, that states my right to vote has been restored, means that Amendment 4, but for the exclusion for murder and sex offense. So one argument is, by the ACLU and others, it's self-executing, fill out Form 39 and go register to vote on January 8th. I think what you were seeing and hearing in that article and at that meeting were some of the supervisors being frustrated that the State Division of Elections was not giving them any more definitive legal guidance, and the current head of the Division of Elections is essentially just saying, you know, this is new, it's open to interpretation, it may, and I think that's the word, the operative phrase, may require a legislative enacting bill. We don't think it does, but certainly if the legislature or the new governor thinks it needs enacting legislation to direct the agencies on how this is going to work, that's certainly their prerogative to do that.
All right. So you mentioned a moment ago, too, slow walking by the legislature. This legislature, and it really hasn't changed much, has interfered with the wishes of voters several times in the past. The Conservation Amendment really hasn't been enacted because of interference by the legislature. And the Medical Marijuana Amendment really hasn't been enacted, I think, the way a lot of people wanted it to be enacted. So this legislature has a track record of interfering with the public's wishes, doesn't it?
Well, I would take a little issue with that. And when I said slow walking, the presiding officers have said in the last week they are not going to do that. The Conservation Amendment had massive budget implications on how that was done and arguably was open to interpretation. So that one needed an implementing bill. Certainly the medical marijuana one needed an implementing bill because somebody had to direct the Department of Health. In fact, the Department of Health was mentioned in the amendment, so there was always going to be an implementing law for the medical marijuana one, so the Department of Health could do administrative rules. Yes, there's been a lot of litigation. Yes, there's been some difference of opinion on how that's working. Here, the amendment, by the way, and it helps, you all may want to put it on your website, says any disqualification from voting, again, remember this now becomes part of the Constitution on January 8th, any disqualification from voting arising from a felony conviction, here are the operative terms, shall terminate, and voting rights shall be restored upon completion of all terms of sentence, including parole or probation. So those are the magic words. The disqualification that says convicted felons can't vote, quote-unquote, shall terminate, and voting rights shall be restored. So John Mills, the former Speaker of the House and Dean of the UF Law School, who wrote this amendment and argued it at the Supreme Court, he believes it's self-executing. The ACLU believes it's self-executing. And, you know, the operative phrase is, have you completed all terms of your sentence? If there's anywhere that's a little bit ambiguous, that's where it is, meaning, to me, that means you're off probation, you paid your restitution, you paid your fines, you paid your court costs, everything's done. And if there's a question, you just show that letter to the supervisor. But the current form, they basically just take your word for it under penalty of a new felony and then check it against the convicted felons database, which heretofore has meant you couldn't vote, and that same list is now the folks that can vote with the exception of the murder or sex offenses. So I think we'll know more. I think you were just seeing in the next month, I think there will be a definitive legal opinion out of the Division of Elections. And places like Tampa Bay that have municipal elections in the spring and around the state, hopefully folks that have not had the opportunity to vote can register in January and February and participate in municipal elections.
If the legislature were to get involved, let me just read from Dennis Baxley, who's a state senator from Ocala. He's a Republican. He's the chair of the Senate Ethics and Elections Committee. His quote in this Tampa Bay Times article is, he said the restoration of voting rights may or may not need legislative action. And he goes on to say, how do you evaluate eligibility? He said, I still have some questions. What were the terms of their sentence? Do they have to meet probation? Did they complete their debt to society or not? So it looks like Baxley is saying it's not clear. If the legislature were to get involved, would you, as an attorney who represents people who are trying to get their rights restored, would you raise your voice and say legislatures stay out of it?
Well, let's keep in mind, and I know Senator Baxley is a man of character, integrity, and strong faith. And I think he's just being honest, like a lot of other people. We just had an election 4 or 5 weeks ago. There were 12 amendments, 11 passed. Several of the counties were involved in recounts. You know, the legislature is literally just now getting sworn in last week and next week and organized, and committee assignments are brand new. So I think he was just honestly saying they're waiting for legal guidance, and I'm sure the senators will ask their own lawyers, policy experts, for their opinion. And I think that is the discussion that will be going on the next 4 or 5 weeks, I think, before January 8th. Certainly, the Division of Elections, if they are going to amend Form 39, they could do that rather quickly with an administrative rule change. I don't think it needs amending, but if they choose to amend it, it could simply ask them, add a new question or a new declaration that says, I am a convicted felon, but I have not been convicted, and then track the exact language of murder or a felony sexual offense. They make that representation under penalty of a new felony. The supervisors in the 67 counties get that and process it no different like they would any other application. They check it against a database in Tallahassee if they want to verify that someone's not been convicted of murder or a sex offense. And then that person gets their card in the mail. I don't know whether it takes 2 weeks or 4 weeks or whatever the procedure is, but I think everybody wants to make this work because 5.1 billion voters voted for this. So I don't think there's some big nefarious plot to undermine the amendment. I think Senator Baxley's comments and others, some of the supervisors were just maybe speaking out loud that we just don't know yet exactly how this is going to work. But I don't think there's anybody plotting and scheming to undermine it.
Well, we're talking with Reggie Garcia, who has represented people before the Clemency Board in Tallahassee trying to get their voting rights restored. Reggie's an attorney, and we're talking about whether or not Amendment 4 is going to be implemented right away or whether or not it's going to be held up by, for instance, the state legislature. Reggie, I asked you a direct question just a moment ago. I think you're too political to answer it directly, but let me try it another way. Would it be a mistake? Would it be a mistake for the legislature to get involved in this? Should they just let it happen?
Well, I'm not going to tell the legislature, who has constitutional power, but both on the budgeting side and on the policy side, not to get involved. I think that's their prerogative if they choose to. Let's remember, we have 20 judicial circuits. We have 67 counties. People are being convicted all day, every day of various crimes in our courts. All of that goes to the Department of Law Enforcement, our state police. That database has to go to the State Division of Elections and in turn back to the 67 supervisors. So there's no question there's an implementation function and arguably an appropriations impact. The question is whether all of that can be done self-executing and seamlessly, or whether a new form through an administrative rule or potentially implementing legislation is necessary. I personally, as a clemency lawyer of 25 years, don't think there needs to be, but if the legislature or the new governor believe there should be, then that's, in my opinion, certainly their prerogative. They may have ideas on how to make it go faster and improve it. Will I step up with my clemency background and offer my opinion? If asked, sure. But I don't think, again, anyone is starting the conversation by saying, let's undermine the will of 5.1 million voters.
Well, I think your reputation with the state legislature is still intact, Reggie. this question, we got a question from a listener. It's a little bit off topic, but I'm going to ask it of you. James sent in this email question. He says, one of the concerns of those felons that are affected by this amendment is that by excluding murder and sex offenses, is that with its passing, our Constitution now has a stated discrimination against a class of people. What do you think?
Well, again, so that your listeners and advertisers know exactly what they're referencing, the Constitution of the state of Florida under Article 6, Section 4 right now, the title is Disqualifications, and it basically says if you're a convicted felon or mentally incompetent, you can't vote or hold office until restoration of civil rights or removal of the disability. That's current law. That doesn't change. Amendment 4 went in and said that disqualification goes away, essentially, when you complete terms of your sentence, unless you are convicted of murder or a felony sex offense. You still have to go through the regular clemency process. I understand the argument. Some people think that amendment, that exclusion is unfair at all. Others, frankly, somewhat appropriately, said the exclusion is not broad enough, that you can be convicted of aggravated assault or kidnapping or, frankly, any violent felony, carjacking, that does not rise to the level of murder or a sex offense and still vote under Amendment 4. And I said, you know what? Yes, you can. And the people that wrote this 5 years ago, I think, were trying to find a balance so that they could honestly politically sell this thing. Remember, you got to get 60% of it to pass. So the gentleman makes a fair point. I don't think that it will be subject to a due process attack because it was put on by the voters and voted by 65% of the voters and become part of the Constitution. It would have to be, the Florida Constitution would have to be attacked and invalidated at the U.S. Supreme Court under due process rights, and there may or may not be litigation about that because of this exclusion. But there's absolutely, it was frankly a political marketing decision made by the people, and I wasn't involved way back then, but the folks that 4 or 5 years ago started working on this said we have to have an exclusion for the most violent felony. And so I think it was somewhat shorthanded and said that, you know, all violent felonies were excluded. That's not correct. The other misperception that this is, quote-unquote, automatic, that's not correct either. The goal is to make it faster than clemency, and it will, and to be streamlined and more efficient. But it's not automatic in the sense that people can just wait for their voter ID card to show up in the mail on January 9th. They have to affirmatively fill out Form 39 and go register just like anybody else, affirmatively registering to vote. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. Well, Reggie, thanks a lot. We'll pay attention to it and see what happens on January 9th. If people can just go down to their supervisor of elections office and sign up to vote, or whether or not the legislature is going to get involved, and we will continue to call on you. So, Reggie Garcia, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF.
Have a good day, Rob.
All right, take care. Bye-bye. Reggie Garcia is an attorney in Tallahassee. He was born and raised in Tampa, and now part of his practice is that he represents people at clemency hearings before the Clemency Board in Tallahassee, which is essentially the Florida cabinet. That's something that's been going on since the start of the Scott administration. Amendment 4 will do away with that process for the most part. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. We're going to open up the phone lines and take your phone calls. I'm going to suggest a few other topics that we could discuss besides Amendment 4. I saw this briefly this morning on one of the cable networks. This is the co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, and she her name is Elizabeth Goteen. She authored a new article in The Atlantic saying that the president can activate an internet kill switch. The president can activate an internet kill switch. You can see the article on The Atlantic website. But let's listen to this interview from this morning from MSNBC with Elizabeth Goteen with the Brennan Center for Justice.
That the president could take should he find himself backed into a political corner once again. Her latest piece for The Atlantic is entitled, What the President Could Do If He Declares a State of Emergency. The co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, Liza Goteen, joins us now. So Liza, talk about your piece, and I think it's more timely than ever when you have a Fox News host suggesting that the United States military could conduct its own investigations on Justice Department officials.
Absolutely. There is a vast set of laws, an entire parallel legal regime that becomes available to the president when he declares an emergency. And the decision to declare a national emergency is entirely within the president's discretion. Now, some of these laws and the powers that they give the president are perfectly sensible, but some of them are more like the stuff of authoritarian regimes. We're talking about powers to shut down wire communications, to freeze Americans' bank accounts, to deploy the military to act as a domestic police force, and more. So this is some very frightening stuff, and we have to think very carefully about whether this system is best serving our democracy in this these rather uncertain times.
So, Liza, if the president did issue a national emergency, he would have to do so under the National Emergencies Act, which would require the office of the president, President Trump, to issue fairly consistent public declarations of why we need this emergency and how things are doing during the ongoing emergency. So this obviously, given his penchant for lying, would be a problem.
Well, actually, there are very, very few constraints on the president's ability to issue the declaration in the first instance, and then it does expire after a year unless he renews it. But renewing the declaration, again, only takes his signature on a piece of paper, so that's really quite easy. Under the National Emergencies Act, which you mentioned, Congress is supposed to meet every 6 months while an emergency is in effect to consider a vote on whether to end the state of emergency. This law has been in place for more than 40 years, and Congress has never met to consider a vote. Congress has never voted on ending a state of emergency. So the oversight that is supposed to be there has really been absent.
So, Liza, you're talking about some extraordinary measures here, an internet kill switch by which the president could assume control of U.S. internet traffic, boots on Main Street in the form of troops, sanctioning Americans. Is there any buffer here whatsoever between the president and taking this action? In other words, who would stand between the president and this act? Is it the Secretary of Defense, for example? Who would it be if there were someone?
Right. Well, we can't really count on the administration to police itself. So we have to look to the other branches of Congress, of the government. We have to look to Congress and we have to look at the courts. Now, one of the things we have to worry about in our current political environment is that Congress and the courts might not really be willing to step in and act as a check. And that's why the system that we have that gives the president so much discretion and then sort of crosses its fingers that Congress and the courts will step in if the president goes too far really needs to be rethought by Congress starting now.
Yeah, not exactly reassuring. Liza Goteen, thank you very much. The piece is in the new issue of The Atlantic. Thanks so much, Liza.
Well, that was an interview this morning on MSNBC with Elizabeth Goteen about her article in The Atlantic about the vast national security powers the president has in the case of a national emergency that he declares. She says that there's little or no congressional oversight over those powers. They would allow President Trump, for instance, to declare martial law, even shut down portions of the internet. He could shut down all wire communications, freeze bank accounts, and deploy the U.S. military as a national police force. So that's an interesting article in The Atlantic. Again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. And our email address here, if you want to comment about anything that we've raised so far, is dj@wmnf.org. This is 88.5 FM. The Washington Post reported last night, and maybe you heard this, but I'm just going to read the first few paragraphs from the Washington Post article that's headlined, Saudi-funded lobbyist paid for 500 rooms at Trump's hotel after 2016 election. And this article says that lobbyists representing the Saudi government reserved blocks of rooms at President Trump's Washington, D.C. hotel within a month of Trump's election in 2016, paying for an estimated 500 nights at the luxury hotel in just 3 months, according to organizers of the trips and documents obtained by The Washington Post. At the time, these lobbyists were reserving large numbers of D.C. area hotel rooms as part of an unorthodox campaign that offered U.S. military veterans a free trip to Washington, then sent them to Capitol Hill to lobby against the law that the Saudis opposed, according to veterans and organizers. At first, lobbyists for the Saudis put the veterans up in Northern Virginia, and then in December of 2016, they switched most of their business to the Trump International Hotel in downtown Washington, D.C. In all, the lobbyists spent more than $270,000 to house six groups of visiting veterans at the Trump Hotel, which Trump still owns. Those bookings have fueled a pair of federal lawsuits alleging Trump violated the Constitution by taking improper payments from foreign governments. During this period, records show the average nightly rate at the hotel was $768. The lobbyists who ran the trip say they chose Trump's hotel strictly because it offered a discount from that rate and had rooms available not to curry favor with Trump. So the headline on that article, Saudi-funded lobbyist paid for 500 rooms at Trump's hotel after 2016 election. So we could talk about that too. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. A lot of people are making a lot, and I don't know if we should make a lot, but I'm just going to mention it, of the body language at the funeral yesterday of President George H.W. Bush. All the remaining living presidents sat in the front row, President Trump, President Obama, President Clinton, President Carter was there. George W. Bush was in a different row on the other side, but a lot was made about the body language. And here's how Fox News described the body language yesterday. This is Fox News host Chris Wallace. Talking about the body language at the funeral yesterday. Listen to what he had to say. And what was your take if you watched the funeral yesterday or saw some of the clips last night on TV?
Ready to listen in really for the whole service. We're not going to talk a lot at all through all of this as the hearse arrives at the cathedral.
Well, I have to say I was struck when President Trump and Melania Trump came to the front row, that it was as if a chill had descended on that front row. You had seen a lot of kind of chatty talk between the Clintons and the Obamas, the Carters. But when Donald Trump sat down, the greeting that he was given by Barack Obama and Michelle Obama was about as cool as it could have been. It seemed like they exchanged hello, morning, and that was it. And at that point, they all stopped talking to each other. And obviously, yes, I agree with Ed, this is the greatness of America, but there also is a reality, and there are some ill feelings among some of the people in the front row. And I have to say that where you usually have a president's club and even people that ran against and maybe one beat the other, that doesn't seem to have been extended to President Trump when you see them sitting in that front row.
Although I will say, listening to Karl Rove depict the situation inside Blair House with the Bush family, it tells a very different story than what we saw between President Trump, then candidate Trump, and obviously the Bush family as he was running against the former Florida governor, Jeb Bush. Martha, we're waiting for the casket to be removed. It will be met here by the bishop.
Well, that was part of Fox News's coverage of the funeral yesterday. Chris Wallace, the Fox News commentator, talked about the chill that was evident when President Trump sat down in the front row at the funeral. There were some other comments about the president, the fact that he didn't seem to know the Christian religious service words that at the funeral, and that he seemed very unfamiliar with how a Christian service like that goes. President Trump having the support of evangelicals in this country, or many evangelicals in this country. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. We're going to take some phone calls right now. James Lyles is our phone producer today. Tina is first in the queue. Hey, Tina, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I just wanted to say something about, you know, what the guest said that you just had about the amendment and people voting on them. I mean, we've had a lot of them the past few years. And it seems to me, and I'm not talking about the ones that came up because of the what do you call it, the Constitutional Revision Commission. I'm talking about ones that were citizens' initiatives, like the felon, you know, restoring rights. It seems like this happens, this kind of thing happens when the legislature is just not honoring the will of the people. Like, this is something that Charlie Crist, he reformed it and made it so that you know, when you completed your sentence, you could get, you know, your rights restored. And it's not just that. I'm just saying, just in general, like the other things that were put on the ballot. It's like the legislature didn't address it. Rick Scott certainly had a draconian policy that he implemented. So people say, well, it's like an end run around the legislature. If the legislature was more responsive to people and maybe more, I don't know what's the word for it. I don't think they represent people. We're so badly gerrymandered. I mean, I live in a district, a Senate district, where that includes Tampa and South St. Pete. I mean, that's gerrymandering. So I think it's done that way to keep the Republicans in office, not necessarily be representative of the people. And so what happens is, you know, people vote on these measures that the legislature didn't want to deal with. And then when they're voted on it and they're adopted, the legislature still drags its feet. So I think people...
Yeah, and that was a question I asked Reggie when Reggie was here. I said, Reggie, don't they have a track record, for instance, in the Conservation Amendment and the Medical Marijuana Amendment? Tallahassee has a reputation of dragging its feet and interfering with the wishes of the voters. Reggie's answer to that was that he thinks that those are complicated amendments and they needed some instruction from the legislature as to how to carry them out. I think a lot of backers of Amendment 4, the felon voting rights restoration law, think that it's a much simpler amendment. Reggie said the word shall is in there twice, so it's got to be done right away. There's no wiggle room. But you even heard Reggie, who was a backer of the amendment, say that maybe the legislature will get involved. They have the right to do so. I think Reggie is saying that because he has to have relations with the legislature from time to time. But you're right, Tina. There have been times in the past where
they're responsive to the people in the state. I think they just don't want to approve the law. They won't bother with it.
And that's why I'm covering the story, because the Times wrote a story that appeared in the Wednesday edition, yesterday's edition. I think people who care about this amendment being implemented have to watch it and dog it.
Stay on top of it.
Exactly.
Because if they can drag it out and prolong it, just like with the medical marijuana, I mean, that was what, 70% people. 70% of the people who voted approved it.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's not even a you know, general use. It's strict parameters in that amendment that
the legislature is so far away. It's up there in Tallahassee, which is really lower Alabama and lower Georgia, and it thinks it can get away with doing all sorts of things, and it thinks that the public doesn't care. Tina, thanks a lot.
Okay.
All right. Good to hear from you. Here we have an open line, 813-239-9663. Blandy writes this, don't forget the hotel room cost was over $750 a night. Yeah, that Washington Post article I read, $768 a night. That was the average nightly rate at the hotel during that period. Although the defenders, the lobbyists said, well, we got a break on the room rate, but we don't know what that break was. So, Blanny, thanks a lot. That is an important number. I have never stayed in a hotel room that costs $768 a night. I don't know if you have, but I know that I've not been in that kind of room. Dennis writes this, having practiced law for 42 years, including more than 30 years handling family law cases, I strongly recommend that those women who had their domestic violence petitions denied by a judge file a complaint against the offending judge with the Judicial Qualifications Commission. The cases you related on the air, and I think Dennis is talking about from a woman's point of view an hour ago. Dennis says the cases you relate on the air should result in those judges being removed from the bench. They are clearly unqualified to sit in a judicial capacity. Dennis commenting about the last hour's show. And then Sound Guy writes this, Fox loves to talk about and analyze the body language of Democrats. I've never seen them turn that scary perception on Trump when he's obviously lying every day. Wonder why that is, writes Sound Guy. Sound Guy, thank you for that. And again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. Mike writes this, he says, Donald Trump always looks to be in physical and psychological pain. If the event is not about him, he's mad if you invite him and mad if you don't. That's Mike's email. And James' email says, how about we forget where the body of the dead president is reposing or the body language of the living presidents at his memorial and start talking about all the dead bodies the former president has left behind. Examples, Panama, Iraq, the drug war, Central America, and the AIDS epidemic. That's Jim in St. Pete. Jim, thanks a lot for that. I got to say that if you were listening to Democracy Now! At all this week, the first 3 days of this week, Amy Goodman did an incredible job covering Iraq, Panama, Central America, and AIDS in the years of Reagan and Bush. So I would recommend, too, if you didn't listen to those shows, Democracy Now!, what a great show. I'm so glad it's on the air, and I hope you get a chance to listen to it at 9 o'clock every day. And then also 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Well, this is WMNF in Tampa. One of the other big issues that's being batted about is the issue of immigrants. And are immigrants a net plus or a net negative for American society? We're going to listen to a piece, and I think I've got this queued up right. I might not. This is Robert Reich, something that he did for a website called Now This, and it's about whether or not immigrants pay taxes. Let's see if I queued this up right.
One of Donald Trump's favorite myths about immigrants is that they don't pay taxes and are a drain on government resources. Well, that's baloney. Here are the facts. Number one, foreign-born Americans pay more than $300 billion in federal, state, and local taxes, according to the most recent data. In some states, immigrants contribute as much as a quarter of all tax revenue. Number two, undocumented immigrants pay taxes too. In 2015, undocumented immigrants paid an estimated $24 billion in federal taxes. They also pay another $11 billion in property taxes and state and local sales taxes. Number three, immigrants strengthen Social Security. Undocumented immigrants alone contribute an estimated $15 billion in Social Security taxes every year, even though they're ineligible for collecting Social Security. And remember, most immigrants are young, thereby strengthening Social Security as more Americans born here retire and begin withdrawing from Social Security. Number four, more immigration is good for the economy. Spending by immigrants drives economic growth and creates jobs, rather than taking them away. All this boosts tax revenues, which reduces the deficit. Number five, historically, new immigrants have contributed more to society in taxes than they've taken from society in terms of public benefits. Generations of immigrants to America have strengthened and enriched this country. So the next time you hear anyone claiming that immigration is bad for the economy, know the truth.
Well, that's Robert Reich, the piece he did this week for the website Now This. Robert Reich, the former labor secretary and economist, saying that foreign-born immigrants contribute $300 billion in taxes to the U.S. economy, that undocumented immigrants contribute $24 billion in federal taxes and then $11 billion in state and local taxes and property taxes, that undocumented immigrants contribute $15 billion to Social Security, money that they will never legally be able to tap into, and that more immigrants create more demand, and it's good for the economy, he says, and that new immigrants take less in public benefits than they pay in taxes. So that's Robert Reich, the former labor secretary under President Clinton. 813-239-9663. Adam writes this. He says, remember when Trump tried to claim he had no business with the Saudis? This hotel deal is another piece that shows that is also a lie. Also said shed some light on why he's so weak on Saudi Arabia. Trump is blatantly violating the emoluments clause right in front of our eyes. Why don't the Republicans care? Writes Adam. And then Captain Tim writes this. He says, is there any law that this man can't break or lie that he cannot tell that will not be excused? It's difficult for me to grasp the fact that I still reside in the USA when a known arch criminal can hold the office of president of the USA and be permitted by the people in the so-called government to do whatever the hell he wants. I need a break from this inexcusable nonsense. When will it come to an end? Writes Captain Tim. And he says, or is this just a futuristic apocalyptic movie coming true? And thanks for helping me cope. So, Tim, thanks a lot. Hope things get better for you. Let's go to Daryl in Tampa. Daryl, you're on WMNF.
Hey, Rob. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm going to be very serious, and, you know, sometimes I try to be jocular and throw names and stuff around, but I'm very serious about this, and one person wrote in that you just read a couple of seconds ago. I totally agree with you. I hope America really gets a belly full of this foolishness and will stop it. And what Fox, Chris Wallace, I said it before, I'll say it again. Why don't you leave that hack of a news network? I won't even strike news from it, and go to a real news network and stop giving legitimacy to that foolishness. You really want to ask that question when the person I heard sat right next to Trump told the American people he's not a U.S. citizen, and his wife said some things. He has something to say to her. He wanted to lock up Hillary Clinton without giving her, you know, a day in court. He said some other things, too, and you wonder why the body language was the way that it was towards him. Are you really kidding me? Now, as far as, like, state of emergency, I think September 11th would really qualify as a state of emergency. And from what I've been told, you know that we're in a state of emergency when the American flag on its borders will have those gold, I don't know what you would call them, tassels all the way around the American flag. That means that we're in what, martial law, a state of emergency. And this would touch on something that was talked yesterday on the executive session into now. You can't just do anything that you want. He's probably doing it because the people who were supposed to be the guardians of our government have looked the other way. If you're going to do something, you have to have proof. Robert Mueller can't just take the word of a slime ball or somebody and say, we got the evidence. No, Robert Mueller's going to tell them, show me the proof, and show me the proof, and convince me of that, I'll believe you. And before I go, back to the subject, Trump may want to try to do something, but he has to have a real legitimate reason why he wants to declare martial law and the military act as the police. Wouldn't that Trump, whatever. I can't think of the word right now. But he can't just do that because, Rob, you got to bear with me.
Yeah, well, Daryl, thanks a lot. Thanks for your call. I'm just going to read a little bit of what this woman says. This is the author of the article in The Atlantic that talks about the president's vast emergency powers when he declares a national emergency, including shutting down the internet, freezing bank accounts, and deploying the military domestically. Her name is Elizabeth Goyton, and she writes, there is a vast set of laws and entire parallel legal regime that becomes available to the president when he declares an emergency. She said that adding such a declaration is entirely up to the president. Some of these laws and powers they give the president are perfectly sensible, but some of them are more like the stuff of authoritarian regimes, she writes. We're talking about powers to shut down wire communications, to freeze Americans' bank accounts, to deploy the military to act as a domestic police force, and more. This is some very frightening stuff. So you can see that article on the Atlantic website. And again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address, dj@wmnf.org. Now I'm going to read some more of these emails that have come in. Here's an email from the from Bill, and he says, on behalf of the big, beautiful wall builders of America, I must point out that the fake news is showing pictures of people climbing walls. Insect climb walls. People cannot. We need the wall. That's Bill's email out there. Bill, thank you for that. Do you think that we need the wall? I'm always struck by the fact that the president campaigned saying that he would build a wall and that Mexico would pay for it. So far, Mexico has not put up any money for the wall. And right now, it looks like we're heading to spend at least $1 billion, if not $5 billion, on the wall. And when the president said that Mexico would pay for it, does that promise matter to anybody? Like Bill, who just emailed me and said, build that big, beautiful wall. Again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. And, you know, a lot of people write emails that don't make sense. So... Chris in Tampa writes this email. He says, I'm glad to see Trump turning those immigrants around. Great job, Trump, writes Chris in Tampa. I wonder what Chris would say about his immigrant forefathers and foremothers. Would he be happy that they would have been turned back if President Trump was president back then when they came from, I'm assuming Chris came from Europe. What would his forefathers and foremothers have said about being turned back if they were fleeing oppression somewhere in the world? And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. And we've opened up the phones, and if there's something that you want to comment about, you can call us up at that number. Lots of donations are coming in. We want to thank... The IBEW, Local 824, just made a nice, very nice contribution to WMNF. And thank you for that. And also, we're getting lots of donations coming in. I think a lot of people are responding to our end-of-the-year appeal for donations. You can make your contribution online. Go to WMNF.org. That's WMNF.org. And make a contribution there. I want to thank John in Ecuador. He listens online. He's a big fan of Stu and Amanda's show. So, John, thanks for making your end-of-the-year contribution to WMNF online. And also thanks to Ron in Lake Wales. He made a $50 contribution. He's a big fan of the Soul Party. And Happy and Patty are big fans of WMNF, and they are making a nice contribution. Thank you for that, Happy and Patty, making the contribution. Gene's in St. Petersburg. He loves all of MNF, and he is making a very nice contribution to WMNF today, too. So thanks to all those people. You can go online, go to WMNF.org. And it says here, this next person is Tampa Cork. Does that, caller, Cork, is that you?
Yeah, Cork, yeah, C-O-R-K, like a wine bottle.
All right, Cork, thanks for calling in. What would you like to say?
Well, the people, the thing about the wall or why immigrants, illegals, come over here is if you paid, supposedly, if you paid Americans enough to work the tomato fields and pick the grapes and do all of that and gave them really good, you know, benefits and things, agriculture and in various jobs, meatpacking and all of this kind of stuff, supposedly then you get all these Americans who take these jobs and they wouldn't need any illegal immigrants. The problem is that nobody in this country, in big business, wants to pay enough to American citizens and give them good benefits on these sorts of jobs. They want cheap labor. And that's why we've never had any change in this whole immigration thing. And a wall will never make a difference because basically American agriculture and big business wants to. And that's all I have to say.
All right, Cork, thanks a lot. Thanks. You know, an interesting thing, too, is that if you're, I think Cork makes a good point. If you paid people, let's say, to harvest produce or citrus, if you paid them instead of piecework, if you paid them $15 or $20 an hour, would you get more Americans to go out and do that? Would you get more people that live here already to do that? And, you know, my experience is that I've picked citrus, and I know how hard it is, and I know how little those people get for picking citrus. And it is a tiny amount of money for a huge amount of work, and it's very hard work. Sometimes there are snakes and other insects in the groves, and the ladders are incredibly heavy, and you, as somebody who picks citrus, you've got to pick every piece of fruit off the tree because the crew leader will come by and tell you, get back up in that ladder because you've got to pick the last of that fruit. But I wonder if anybody has picked fruit and then thinks that, you know, they would like to do that as a career or even as an entry-level job. What do you think? 813-239-9663. Let's go back to the phones. We're going to go to Nancy in St. Pete. Hi, Nancy. Thanks for calling in.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, we got this thing, this conundrum about, you know, wanting something for nothing, and we just can't seem to get over it, you know? I mean, we've done it with slavery. We've done it, you know, and we've done it with women. And you know what? It's like time is up. My husband was reading to me this morning from our Advent book, okay? And it was about St. Nicholas and how he started. And guess how he started back in 329 A.D.? He started by throwing bags of money through people's windows. He was a monk, and the thing was back then that a woman had to have a dowry and so that she could get married. And if she didn't have a dowry, then she would probably have to prostitute herself. So either way, we're going to get some money out of this woman, okay, who's, you know, good for nothing, you know, except, you know. So that's how he started out, by throwing bags of money through his friends' windows so that those guys would have dowries for their daughter. You know, and he read that to me. He says, isn't that great? And I said, no, it's terrible. You know, why don't we hit the problem head on and say, let's do something about this system. Let's do something about this awful dowry system instead of finding ways around it. We are always finding ways around stuff rather than attacking it at its root. And, you know, I mean, I'm 73 years old now, and I'm just sick to death of this whole thing. And, you know, and it just goes on and on and on, and we never find any kind of a solution because we don't want to, because we want something for nothing.
All right, Nancy, thanks a lot. Thanks.
You bet.
I didn't know that.
Bye.
About St. Nicholas. All right, thanks.
Yeah, that's something.
That is. Let's go to Corinne in St. Petersburg. Hey, Corinne, you're on WMNF. We just have 30 seconds.
Oh, boy, you don't have enough time for me. Okay, I would like to remind everybody that the Jews were turned around, and a whole shipload of Jews were turned away from the United States during World War II.
That's true.
And I know a lot of people know this, a lot of people don't. I am so ashamed of my country for that. And then number two, I'd like to know how this guy gets a chance to spend $1 billion on a wall without having a bill go through Congress and having us vote on it. How could this happen?
Well, I think Senator Schumer and him are negotiating right now, and I think Schumer has agreed to $1 billion. So we'll see where it goes. Corinne, thanks a lot.
So Schumer's going to pay for
this? Well, we're going to follow it. He agreed last week to $1 billion. All right, Corinne. If you want to we'll continue to cover it. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up, 813-238-8001, and record your comment on the comment line, which is extension 115. And I'll play your comments back tomorrow. Thanks to James Lyles. This is WMN.